latest Fulham's Fan Podcast. I'm Kyle Caldwell, your host. I am the Collective's editor at Interactive Investor. Later on in the podcast is an interview with Ken Wootton, who is a fund manager that specialises in investing in UK smaller company shares. But before that, me and Tom Bailey, the ETFs editor at Interactive Investor, are going to chat through a couple of news items that are related to funds and investment trusts. Tom, let's start off with dividends. The latest global dividend index from Janus Henderson has just been published earlier this week. It seems to be, on the whole, good news for investors, with global dividends expected to regain their pre-pandemic highs by the end of this year. Is it all as good as it seems, Tom?
Yeah, I'd say it's mostly seems like good news. So the report showed that global dividends totaled just over $400 billion in the third quarter of 2021. That's an all-time high for a third quarter. And in total, something like 90% of companies either raised their dividends or held them steady in the quarter. That's a much higher number than usual. And then one thing that stood out, though, is that it was really the mining sector that carried the weight here. So two-thirds of the year-on-year growth in payments in the third quarter was down to that sector alone.
So looking ahead to 2022, there's potentially a danger that global dividend growth may disappoint, given that, as you've mentioned, Tom, the miners have been such a big contributor to global dividend growth this year on the back of rising commodity prices. And given the volatile nature of commodity prices, I wouldn't bank on those companies continuing to pay dividends at such high levels.
Well, yeah, this is kind of the complex macro questions that kind of feed into these things. So, you know, it depends on the ability of commodity prices to remain elevated. So is the surge in commodity prices simply, you know, the reflect of the global economy coming back online, the kind of end of the lockdowns, and we'll kind of see that effect peter out? Or as kind of some places such as Goldman Sachs are predicting, you know, we're on the cusp of a new commodity supercycle, driven somewhat ironically by the growth of clean energy. So, you know, electric cars, wind turbines, solar panels, all these are actually very metal heavy, have a very metal heavy manufacturing process, take a lot of metal inputs. So obviously that will lead to a sustained increase demand in metals down the line. Although then on the other hand, we see, say, China, one of the biggest commodity consumers in the world, move away from its very investment-heavy economic model. That's seen by some as a threat to commodity prices there. So, you know, these are very hard questions to predict. So you're right, there is that risk out there for income investors that the big payers are becoming commodity producers, but at the same time, how long can that last?
But a big positive is that global dividend cover is expected next year to reach its highest level since 2013. Dividend cover is a ratio that measures a company's income to its dividend payment. It's a very useful measure as it indicates how sustainable a company's dividend is. And as a rule of thumb, a low dividend cover of around 1x or lower suggests that dividends are vulnerable, as the company is using most, if not all, of its profits to fund the dividend. A figure of 2 or more, however, is viewed as comfortable because this is a sign that a business is not over-distributing on the dividend front. And it's expected that for 2022, according to Janus Henderson, that dividend cover will be 2.4x, up from 2.1x this year. So this indicates that companies across various industries and sectors are on a global scale in a healthy position to increase the dividend payments next year, and that in theory, dividend cuts will be lower in terms of number of companies than in previous years. We're now going to move on to junior ISAs. It was the 10th anniversary of the junior ISA at the start of the month. Research from funds rating agency Fundcalibre revealed how parents who had the luck or foresight to pick one of the top 20 fund performers over the past decade, how well they've been handsomely rewarded. I mean, given that we have that benefit of hindsight, Tom, the fact that 17 of the top 20 performing funds over the past decade invest in the US or technology sectors, that does not come as much of a surprise.
No, of course not. I mean, the past decade has been defined by the continued outperformance of large cap growth stocks, principally in the US market and in the tech sectors or kind of tech adjacent sectors. There's kind of multiple theories on this. Obviously, we've seen the rise of the kind of platform economy, but also the idea of low interest rates or the kind of the weak recovery we saw after 2008 crash kind of has lent itself towards the outperformance of these particular types of stocks. I mean, whatever the actual explanation, and people can continue to debate this. It's obviously no surprise then that the best performers were names like Baillie Gifford American, Morgan Stanley US Growth, Fidelity Global Technology. And so in the case of Baillie Gifford American, over that 10-year period, it would have turned £3,600, into just over 36K, obviously a huge amount. The trouble, of course, though, is that many parents still open cash ISA over a stocks and shares ISA, which arguably is not the best approach. At least as we can see with these statistics over the past decade, with a huge bull run in stocks.
Yes, that's correct, Tom. Parents do tend to be overly cautious in favouring the cash version of the junior ISA. The latest statistics show that in the 2018-2019 tax year, money was put into 954,000 junior ISAs, with 70% of those being cash ISAs and the remaining 30% being the stocks and shares ISA version. As the money cannot be accessed until a child's 18th birthday, parents risk being too cautious in favouring cash over stocks and shares. While there are no guarantees, history shows that this is an adequately long enough time period to ride out the peaks and troughs that are part of investing in the stock market. And a final point to make is that the rules do permit parents to open one cash ISA and one stocks and shares ISA. So you can mix and match between the two. You don't have to choose one or the other.
So I assume for your kids, Carl, you've opened the stocks and shares version of the junior ISA.
Yes, that's correct. First and foremost, I think obviously as a financial journalist, it's very important for me to practice what I preach. So I've got a 4-year-old son and an 18-month-year-old daughter. And yeah, they both have the stocks and shares version of the junior ISA. And they're both invested in investment trusts. My son is invested in the Aberdeen Asia Smaller Companies Investment Trust. And my daughter's ISA is in the Edinburgh Worldwide Investment Trust. And one of the reasons why me and my partner picked those investment trusts over others is because they both invest in smaller companies. And as history has shown time and time again, smaller companies over the very long term outperform larger companies. It's called the small cap effect. And I wanted my children to hopefully benefit from that.
I suppose that the main risk with a junior ISA is that when the child turns 18, they can do whatever they want with it. So if you do see these great returns in the study we spoke about earlier, it's their choice how to spend it.
Yes, that's right, Tom. That when a parent sets up a junior ISA, they've effectively cut a key for their children to use and withdraw all the cash in one fellow swoop if they wish when they turn 18. I mean, with my two children, I'd hope that the money is spent sensibly, or that my son and daughter continue to invest towards one of the big goals in life, such as owning a property. But, it won't be for me to decide. And against that, though, the money, as the money in the junior ISA is held in the child's name, it does mean the parents cannot just dip into it if they have a shortfall. Some parents may view that as an advantage, and others may view that as a disadvantage. I mean, if parents do want to have control, then given that the ISA allowance is, very generous at £20,000 a year, and it may be an allowance for many that they don't fully utilise, then another approach could be to use some of that allowance to invest for your child, and keep it separate from your own. But you'd have to do that sort of manually yourself.
For our fund manager interview, I'm joined by Ken Wotton, who is a smaller company fund manager at Gresham House. Ken runs three UK smaller company open-ended funds. He also runs the Barronsmead VCTs and also manages the Strategic Equity Capital Investment Trust. So Ken, could you firstly run through your investment philosophy? What sort of qualities do you look for in a company? And also, what do you not like to see that would put you off from investing?
Yeah, firstly, in terms of our investment philosophy, We describe our process as taking a private equity approach to public markets. And what we mean by that is we're trying to help to build better businesses. So we're actively engaged investors. We're trying to find high quality companies, and you know, that's partly about financial metrics. So we're looking for businesses that have sort of attractive margins, that have you know, high return on capital, that are profitable, that generate cash, that are growing, attractive growth rates, but also not just the financial metrics. It's also about the business, the fundamental quality. So high quality management teams, good alignment of interest with us as shareholders, attractive market opportunities, and you know, building conviction that the companies have, you know, a sustainable competitive advantage in what they're doing, something different, whether that's intellectual property or you know, a strong customer base, contracted recurring revenue. Depends on the company and the sector. So we like high quality companies. We're long-term investors. We like to engage actively with the management teams, and where relevant and where possible, we want to make introductions to our network and contribute to sort of introducing people who can help them to pursue their strategy. So that's our philosophy and the types of company we look for. So we try to avoid businesses that are loss-making, businesses that don't generate cash, businesses that are too highly leveraged. And also, we avoid certain sectors and certain sort of end market characteristics. So we don't invest in sectors like oil and gas, mining, parts of real estate, because they are sectors that are affected by big external factors that are outside the control of the management team, and also that areas, you know, things like the oil price, which I don't feel I'm particularly well qualified to try and call. And then we also avoid heavily loss-making businesses, early stage technology, binary sort of drug development that where the investment case is reliant on drug being approved or not. So those kind of more volatile, more binary type investment situations where you might get a great upside if it goes well, but the downside risk is very high as well. So we're trying to deliver good quality returns, but also consistency. And so we try to screen out some of those areas of the market which are more volatile.
So it's very much a bottom-up stock-picking style rather than taking into account macroeconomic factors.
Yeah, I think our process is designed to, as much as possible, obviously we can't be completely, but to be somewhat insulated from the wider market and the wider economy. So we want to find businesses that can deliver the investment returns that we're anticipating, regardless of whether they've got a tailwind or a headwind from the overall economy, because they have structural growth or something specific about their situation, which means that they can deliver and grow and sort of deliver returns, even if the economy isn't helping them. And that's our philosophy, which means we don't sort of chop and change our portfolio to try and call the economic cycle, the market cycle. We're trying to deliver consistency throughout the market cycle.
You mentioned there headwinds and tailwinds, and in terms of the UK stock market, there's been a number of headwinds facing the market for some time, but both domestic and international investors are still holding back from increasing exposure to the UK despite some of those headwinds, the Brexit vote and COVID-19, the pandemic. Despite those headwinds becoming less of a headwind than they were, investors are still shying away from the UK. Why do you think that is, and what do you think the catalyst will be for investors to return to the UK market?
I think you're absolutely right that the UK market has been out of favour for quite some time. I think really it dates back to the Brexit referendum result in 2016. And so there's been outflows and sort of asset allocators have been underweighting the UK really since then. I think, there's a bit of a structural shift, which is a greater asset allocation towards global equity funds rather than sort of specific country funds, which I think has been a factor. But I think mainly it's been a view on the UK economy, driven by Brexit. And then during the pandemic, I think there was a period where because Britain was perceived to be ahead of the curve in terms of vaccine deployment and rollout, you know, there was a bit of interest again in the UK, and sort of on a relative basis, there were some flows coming back. I think that's stalled somewhat in recent months. And look, I think the catalyst will be, you know, evidence of, you know, good recovery and economic recovery in the UK, and evidence that the UK can deliver sort of sensible economic growth. But again, as I said before, we as investors are trying to look through that, not try and make a major call on whether the UK economy is going to be in favour or not in favour, or grow faster or not than other markets. But would you take some comfort from, in terms of, you know, I guess things like the risk of a market correction? I think the fact that the UK has been trading for a persistent material multi-decade discount to other developed markets, particularly the US, and the fact that smaller companies, you know, are trading on multi-year discounts to larger UK listed companies, I think that both those discounts do actually give us some mitigation and some insulation from sort of the volatility we're seeing across global stock markets at the moment. So, you know, I'm not sure what the catalyst will be. I don't necessarily see one short term for a major rethink in terms of asset allocation to the UK, but I do feel that the downside risk is somewhat protected by the valuation discrepancy.
And is there a danger that investors will remain on the sidelines for too long and miss the opportunity of UK shares being this cheap compared to overseas markets? I mean, smaller company funds and trusts have performed really well over the past year, including the funds that you manage. I think the sector average is around 50% over the past year. So, I mean, to me, that sort of makes me think, have investors potentially already missed the boat?
I don't really think so. I think, you know, that very strong performance over the last year, you know, it does come on the back of an extremely sort of sharp decline in stock markets at the beginning of 2020 on the back of the pandemic. So, you know, there's a material element of recovery in that performance number. I think, you know, periodically small caps do have, you know, a stellar year, but we're really trying to look for consistent through the cycle returns from our funds. So, you know, I don't think that investors have missed out on the opportunity in UK small cap. I think there's a really attractive opportunity at the moment. The discontinuity caused by COVID and lockdowns and the uneven recovery in terms of how different sectors perform means that there's loads of opportunity at the moment. And whilst there are some pockets of stretched valuations, particularly in sort of, you know, really high growth tech areas of the market, actually I think, you know, there's whole swathes of the kind of more normal economy and other sectors where there's still really good value. And you can see that from the spate of takeover offers that we've seen across the market over the last 12 months. You know, I can't remember a time in my career where I've seen quite so many takeover offers. And it's across the market cap spectrum, it's not just in small cap. And you've got, you know, ranging right up to some Morrisons in the FTSE 100. So you've got smart, you know, either private equity or trade buyers who are sophisticated and who understand particular sectors or areas who are seeing really attractive value in UK listed equities at the moment. So I think, yeah, until that discount to overseas markets closes, I think there's still a good opportunity for investors to make good returns out of this area.
So in terms of recent portfolio activity, are there any holdings or sectors that you would highlight that you've been adding to lately?
And we're not really sort of sector focused investors in terms of that. We don't make individual investment decisions in order to try and sort of add weightings to particular sectors because we've got a particular macro view. So we're very much bottom up investors, and our sector weightings are the consequence of our bottom up stock selection. So yes, there are companies that we've been adding to lately. I think, you know, we've been doing. In terms of our overall positioning, over the last 12 to 18 months, you know, the broadly what we've been doing has been taking profits in some areas of the portfolio which have performed really strongly, where, you know, resilient businesses that have performed well through the pandemic period and have, you know, not only have they performed well from a sort of earnings perspective, but the share prices have sort of discounted that and then some. So they've sort of shares have performed better than the earnings, and they've gone to premium ratings. So we've taken the opportunity to either take top slice or fully exit some businesses in that category. Things like S4 Capital, Martin Sorrell's digital marketing consultancy, fantastic business, grown brilliantly, but now trading at very, very premium valuation. Impact Asset Management, fantastic business, ESG and sustainability focused asset management business. We've been in for a really long time, one of our best ever contributors to our performance. And that, you know, but that's gone to a premium multiple on the back of really, really big focus on ESG over the last 12 to 24 months. Again, we've taken the opportunity of that demand for those shares to exit at really attractive returns. We've recycled those returns into areas of the market that have been sort of slightly left behind in the recovery. So areas like leisure. So we've got investments across a number of different leisure stocks, such as we own Everyman Cinemas, and we own Loungers, the cafe bar operator. We own the City Pub Company, independent sort of freehold pub operator. We have the Gym Group, the low-cost gym operator, and Ten Entertainment Group, the number two 10-pin bowling operator in the UK. And all of those stocks clearly have been impacted materially through COVID because of lockdowns. But all of them, we think, have got great quality management teams. The balance sheets are in a strong position, and actually, on a relative competitive basis, as we emerge from COVID and things return to normal, we think all of them are sort of actually probably better positioned from a competitive point of view compared to some of their independent peer group than they were pre-COVID. So there's areas like that. And then we've been selectively adding to investing in a few IPOs. So there's been a number of IPOs. I mean, actually, the level of IPOs has been sort of elevated for quite some time during this year. And we're very selective, but because of our private equity approach and our wider divisional platform of Gresham, where we've got private and public equity in the same business, we've got a really great network in the private equity sphere. You know, often we can really diligence some of these companies very effectively before they IPO, because we've got some touch points in private markets who can reference them. So, as I said, on a very selective basis, we've been adding to few names in the IPO market. And to name a couple, there's a business called Cooth, which is a sort of software and services provider into the NHS, providing services around mental health provision to children and young people. So it's good sort of socially beneficial service they're providing. But it's also done on a very attractive revenue model, where it's sort of multi-year contracted recurring revenue, and it's grown fantastically since the IPO late last year. Another one, Elixir, which is a digital transformation consultancy business, which advising big corporates on their digital strategy and the implementation of technology. And that's a really hot area at the moment, where there are pretty much every company in every sector is trying to think through how technology can support their business, either to be more efficient or to attract more customers to help them grow. And that's where Elixir are right in the sweet spot of that, and helping those companies to deliver on their strategy. So it's been growing fantastically, and the share price has followed along with that. So there's great opportunities at the moment. Just sort of, you need to look at, and within small cap, the great thing about that part of the market is there's always interesting opportunities. It's a dynamic market. There's always new companies coming along, new opportunities.
And when you're examining new opportunities, and indeed, examining the rest of the current holdings in your portfolios, how much do you factor in something like inflation, which is on the rise at the moment, and the consumer prices index is expected to average around 4% next year?
Great question. I think inflation is clearly a sort of very front of mind for a lot of investors at the moment. It's it's an issue which has certainly contributed to the sort of increasing volatility in the market at the moment, relative to earlier on in the year. And I think it's real. I mean, so we can have a debate about whether it's transitory or structural. I'm on the sort of transitory, I'm in the transitory camp, I guess, but you know, I'm not an economist, so I'm not trying to really call that. I think what I would say in terms of our portfolios, most of the businesses that we invest in, because they're high quality companies that have got a structural competitive advantage of some sort, that's what we seek. That means they've got pricing power, which means that even if they do see cost inflation coming through, it is likely that they can pass that on. And also, you know, we like growing businesses. Typically, our companies have low levels of debt, and they have, you know, potential for positive operational gearing as they grow their revenue. So, you know, they have scope within their margin structure to, I guess, absorb inflationary cost pressures, you know, because their margins are expanding as they grow. So, you know, I'm not, you know, blind to the risks around inflation, and there are, you know, there are some of our companies which are more exposed, but the majority of our companies are relatively well positioned to deal with inflation, and you know, that's down to the types of businesses that we like to invest in.
And finally, a question that we ask all our fund manager guests: do you have skin in the game? I know you manage a number of funds. Do you invest in all of them?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's not a mandatory requirement of working here that we have to invest in all of our funds, but personally I do invest in all the funds that I manage, because firstly I absolutely believe in what we're doing, and I have high conviction in the portfolios we manage, and you know, I'd rather put my own money behind the investment portfolios that I have high conviction in, and the highest conviction I have is in the ones that I manage myself. So I absolutely have you know, material personal investments in all of the funds that I manage, and I think it also sort of avoids any conflicts of interest. So I'm not investing in individual stocks that, you know, could also be going to the fund, or you know, because that just creates too much complexity. I think if we're going to have exposure to attractive small cap investments that I think are going to go up, then I'll do that through our funds.
Ken, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
That's it for this week. Please do check out ii.co.uk for the latest fund spotlight. There's also lots more fund, investment trust and ETF content on the website. I hope that you've enjoyed the podcast. Please do spread the word, like and subscribe. We'll be back in early December.